That's the great lady of the Hammond organ, Shirley Scott, providing a lovely welcome for Eddie Lockjaw Davis, who you'll hear later, and Jerome Richardson on flute, also you'll hear him later, on this nifty little number called Skillet. That's from Davis's Cookbook Volume 2 album, released in 1958. George Duvivier on double bass and Arthur Edgehill on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, May the 21st, and the day after the great Super Tuesday elections. And we'll talk about that because, you know, I wasn't overwhelmed. I wasn't underwhelmed. I wasn't even whelmed by these elections. They made very little impact on me, despite the efforts of the media mindbenders to tell us that this was a very significant race and it portends so much for the upcoming presidential race in 2016. And of course, by the end of this year, after the general election, whether it would change significantly the power equation in the U.S. Senate, in Congress generally, and governorships around the country. Well, of course, the midterm election season kicked off yesterday in six states: Arkansas, Georgia, Idaho, Kentucky, Oregon, and Pennsylvania. And much was made of this. A lot of anticipation, a lot of maps and experts talking about these candidates. And I still tell you, I'm very prejudiced here. This seemed to me, this whole thing, confirmed a discussion we had earlier, not too long ago actually, last month, about the duopoly, the Republicans and the Democrats. And when you look closely at these candidates, those who prevailed in the runoffs yesterday, you find a very interesting thing about it. It's like this is a whole other world, and we're just observers because we know, as a public and those of you who still do vote, this is the best that they can offer for your consideration, and particularly, supposedly pertaining to your needs and your day-to-day life and the problems that afflict Americans in general. But of course, what this really is a kind of contest for membership in the club. You know, the memberships are up. It's like one of these elite clubs where they believe every so often they have to take a look at the membership rolls and kind of shake things up a little just to convince themselves that they are, in fact, an elite core, an elite group, and that membership would not come easy. So they put you through the paces. If you really value membership in this club, you will do what you have to do to show, you know, your willingness to conform, your willingness to be part of the elite of America, the people who basically are the power of America, at least on the political level. And they have these contests, and more, and maybe it's because I'm just getting older, and that's part of the process of getting older. You just dispense with things that really shouldn't take up too much space in your head. And you hold on to those things that you really must pay attention to. And this is not one of them for me. What I saw was America's, that other America. This is not America, it's that other America that was having a conversation and a closed, a very perverted kind of public and closed at the same time meeting. Open to the public, but we know it's really very closed. And for membership in this club, people spend a lot of money. And just as usual, a lot of them spent millions of dollars, millions of their own dollars. And that has become the narrative of American politics. You can buy your way in. And the vote is a mere formality because the process of selection and the process of election are two entirely different things. When the minions are told to show up, as they were for yesterday's vote in these six states, they're there to participate in the process of election of candidates they had no part in selecting. That is a strictly party business. The party decides who is going to be the standard bearer for the Republicans and who will be the standard bearers for the Democrats. Your job as a supposedly informed voter is to show up at the appointed time and perform this ceremony called election. You go to the polling site and you flick a lever for person A or person B, whoever it is, who has spent more money than the other to make an impression on your mind via media ads. I have no idea about these folks, about their character, what they stand for, what they think is important, what do they have in common with you, what do you have in common with them, whether they recognize any of your interests as even being on the radar for them to pay attention to. And then at the end of the day, the votes are tallied up and the media people make a big, big thing about the analysis of this very complex process because, of course, America has voted. We just saw a real demonstration of democracy with the elections in India, as I had commented just earlier in the week. But this is the sordid process that we go through. And whether we like it or not, whether we participate or not, it goes on. With all of the contradictions, with all of the things that make it a really awful expression of supposedly people's democratic rights. Why should we have all this money involved? Why aren't real candidates coming forward? What is the link between these people and the realities that people are living with every day? What is their commitment? They're not committed to people. For the most part, I would say overwhelmingly, these candidates are committed to party. They're committed either to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or the Tea Party or some other kind of party. But they're not committed to the voters. They're not committed to people. They're not committed to improving the conditions of life. That's a distant second. First, they're committed to party. And that's the discussion. Even the media mindbenders are not hiding it. They're talking very openly about what these elections will mean about the power of the respective parties in Congress, whether one party, the Republican Party, would be even more successful this time around at blocking the Democrats, or whether the Democrats would pick up a seat or two that would help them flex their muscle more effectively against the Republicans. But either way, as the African proverb says, when two elephants fight, it's the grass that loses. When are we going to get to that? In these elections, you read about people, you know, CFOs and CEOs of companies and people who, for all intents and purposes, are not at all representative of the average American. Nobody's a working person. And then we have what are called the legacy candidates. We have people literally getting elected on the basis of the recognition of their last names. We have Michelle Nunn, Sam Nunn's daughter. We have Jason Carter, the grandson of Jimmy Carter. You have Alison Lundgren Grimes, daughter of Kentucky's Democratic Party chairman, Jerry Lundgren. You have Mark Pryor, son of the former governor and former Senator David Pryor of Arkansas. That's what politics is right now. It's not an earnest, heartfelt desire to really turn this country around, to get at the root of these basic questions that in 2014 still afflict us in the same way as it did in the 1700s. What is the relationship between government and the governed? What is the concept? What is the operative concept of the Democrats? What is the operative concept of the Republicans? What is the thinking about their purpose in public life, in public office? What are they there for? Increasingly, we know it's all about them and their private interests, their resumes, their good welfare, and the good that they can get, what they can get, how well they can position themselves to become even richer, more powerful, and more tied into the nexus of power in the United States. I read the other day, and I was cracking up, Joe Biden, his youngest son, he's now on the board of directors of Ukraine's largest oil company at the time that the U.S. is urging Ukraine to develop energy independence from Russia. And guess what? Joe Biden says this has nothing whatsoever to do with the fact that he's vice president. His son is a private citizen, and therefore he is able to do whatever he can. We see this. This is a kind of insult, really, to the public sensibility about what this whole process ought to mean, what it ought to be about. People are catching hell in this country. And for that group that historically has controlled the mechanisms of power in the United States, and now they have partnered even more overtly with corporate America, so they're now, they're not even apologetic about it, they're not even hiding it. They are partners in using politics not as a means to deliver good, the good for everyone, the aggregate good of everyone. They are there openly as an oligarchy. The government by the wealthy and the powerful. And they pull the wool over our eyes, as in these scheduled elections, and they tell you that this is about democracy, and that you are actually having a hand in determining the course of this country, and that you are selecting your leaders who already have been selected for you. So, the question here is, what did yesterday's elections mean to you? We could take your calls at 888-874-4888. Let's hear what you think. What did yesterday's election mean to you? Did you feel that you were a part of this process, that you're excited about being a member of the electorate, doing your duty, exercising your franchise? Are you a proud voter this year? Will you be one of the people who believes that you are? In fact, you are protecting your interests and your rights when you vote. Is this what the process means to you still? Let's hear what you have to say. 888-874-4888. I look at it that the questions that need to be asked, especially by those who are covering, so-called covering elections in the United States, we have to get to this philosophical question, which people think is, you know, irrelevant. The question in elections is usually, are you going to win and are you going to lose? You know, how much money do you have in your war chest? You know, how long could you sustain an effective advertising campaign? You know, what kind of money are you able to raise? And it's on that basis that they predict the success of a candidate. But what about the process that yields this candidate or these candidates? What about the process even after election? What is this whole governmental structure supposed to be about and mean to the average voter? What is the state of affairs there? And are we not deluding ourselves? And aren't the media themselves agents of this miseducation by insisting on avoiding the big question? Hello, Dallas. Sarah, you're on the air.
Greetings to you, Utrice.
Thank you. You too.
Yes, ma'am, and greetings as well to the PRN listening audience. Well, Utrice, you know it hasn't come across here to Texas, but since you're speaking about my former home state, and that's the same thing I've said all along, Utrice, is that that's why I stopped voting, because you've laid out the case where these people, these candidates are selected by the party, they're put out here, and everyone is running around here to vote them into office. And, of course, whoever pays the most to put them in office or funded their campaign, that is who they're beholden to, and that is whose phone calls will be first answered. And you're not going to be looked at until 6 months out for re-election. Then they're going to be back in their district. So this is all a show pony. Right now what they have, this was just like the pre-Grammy party that they did on yesterday to trot out all of these candidates and get them reacquainted with the voters. And, of course, we already know that black people, because in the state of Georgia, name recognition has pretty much have it hands down, because I pulled up the election results for that particular state, and I saw, of course, Jason Carter as a Democratic nominee for governor, he was unopposed. So therefore, he is finished in his run until the primary election coming up in November. And Michelle Nunn, of course, and a couple others who are in there running for the Senate position. This is all showboating. You know, black people like to think that, okay, the Democrats are going to do something for them. But as you said and as you've laid it out, the Democrats are the party of the Ku Klux Klan. That is where the Klan came out of. And they are never going to do anything for us, as the ancestor Malcolm has stated. You know, you could either choose to be hanged from a lower branch or a high branch, but any which way, you're going to still end up getting hung. And we like to keep playing in a game that we know, we don't know the rules of it. We don't have all of the cards. As I said, you're pulling a race card or whatever the case might be. Therefore, it means to say that somebody else is holding the whole deck of the other 51 cards, and you're only allowed to pull out one. So we like being played with, and we like being tossed around on a deck, and we keep going back in and into this system, which is why I said I choose not to participate. It's time that we all should stand back and not participate. Because you've said the same thing that I've always said, like the Edward Bernays wrote in his book on propaganda, and he laid it out in there about what it means to be giving you this perception that you're really doing something by going out and voting. They give you that this is just like giving a child a toy to play with to distract you, keeping you busy to make you think as if though you're doing something, but you're not. Because if politics and election was really going to do something, they never would have even offered it or put it on the table for anyone to get into it. It would have, this whole system would have remained somewhat of a dictatorship, or it would have stayed as a monarchy that it came out under from Great Britain. But we are not thinking people.
So what is the alternative? While you absent yourself, let's say, what is the alternative in terms of a political mechanism?
As you said, Utrice, what you can do is go after these businesses who are basically running this country. Their products are being made out of the United States, and it's coming back in country in order for it to sell and for you to consume and buy it. What we need to do is we need to tailor our consumerism. We need to cut it back, and we need to stop. I was listening to a program that came on after yours on Monday, and I believe it was Richard Martin, and he was talking about the downturn in the economy and the driving rate of people in this country to do extracurricular activities such as shopping and whatever compared from the 90s to now, and how it has drastically declined. And how all of these boarded up stores, and I've noticed the same thing when I'm driving around. I'm seeing all of these stores, all of these vacant for rent for lease in all of these shopping malls and strip malls where people are no longer able to maintain the rent because people are not buying. You need people to come in and buy in order for you to stay in business. So what we can do is we can put a hurting on them because these people are making their money off of us. They're selling you the goods, and you're foolishly running out here and buying them like this weekend coming up here. A lot of people are going to be running up in the stores and buying barbecue grills and patio furniture and all this other stuff, you know, to go out here and celebrate.
But that's a political – I mean, that's an economic response. What's the political response?
I really and truly don't see anything what we can do politically because we have let this horse out the barn. The barn is burnt down. So I don't really see what you can do except this whole system need to collapse. And the only way for it to collapse is you need not participate in it. This thing have to implode on its own. And we are shoring it up because every time we go out here, and this it's based on the good faith of people to keep it propped up, and black people have more faith in this system, and we get the least amount from out of it. We're the ones who, that's why they're always in our corner trying to tell us we need to shore it up, because we give it more energy than it really needs.
Well, okay. Thanks for your observation.
Thanks, you, Tree.
Thank you. That takes us to the halfway point. We'll take a break and come back and talk about Nigeria right after this.
Thank you.
You're listening to These Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Nutrice Lead, and we're talking about what's going on in the world around us. We just climbed out of we're a day out of the so-called Super Tuesday. I'm chuckling because I just saw a reaction on leadstories@gmail.com from Nathaniel. He says that, which party, Louis the 15th or the Marie Antoinette party? Which party wins? You know, this is where we are for a lot of folks, and I think that discussion needs to start picking up a pace, people examining publicly, what does it mean, this political process? What does it mean? And, you know, as opposed to what it supposedly should mean and what it has come to mean. Well, we shift gears a bit and we're looking now at the situation in Nigeria. The death toll, of course, from yesterday's twin bombings in the city of Jos is headed north, way north of 118. Two car bomb blasts detonated yesterday in the same city where on Christmas Day in 2011, the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for two bombs that killed 41 people. Police were able to disarm two other bombs. And overnight, we're told that the news reports are that an additional 26 people have been killed also, allegedly by the group Boko Haram in villages close to Chibok, where an estimated 278 girls, and the figure is still a little bit amorphous, were abducted on April the 14th from their school dorms and are still missing. Here we have a crisis of, incredible proportions, incredible suffering occurring in a country that supposedly is now Africa's largest economy, surpassing that of South Africa to become number one. It is also Africa's most populous state. The president, Goodluck Jonathan, is frankly coming across as a very placid, way too placid for the conditions that obtain in his country. Yesterday, for example, we learned via an official statement that he condemns the bombings. Well, thanks a lot for that. That's a good thing that you condemn the bombings, President Jonathan. But what happens? What is supposed to happen in Nigeria? From everything that we have been talking about, it would suggest that the group Boko Haram, or maybe other groups in conjunction with it, see the opportunity now to just rev up this violence to cause a major conflict to break out, a huge conflict to break out, the aim of which still remains unclear. People are saying, well, it's about establishing an Islamic state in the northern region. Is it that simple? There are many things at work here. We learned, of course, in the last couple of days that we had a meeting over the weekend in France, of all places, and that too is symbolic, a meeting convened by President Hollande in France of leaders of African nations, neighboring African nations, and trying to solicit ideas as to how to proceed with Boko Haram and the escalating terrorism that is unfolding in Nigeria and that has every indication that it would spread. So the presidents of Benin, Cameroon, Niger, no, Niger, and Chad also attended this meeting. We've had the United States and Israel also pledging, and Britain pledging support on the intelligence gathering level in the search for the girls. But also we know that this, we can't discount all of the covert efforts, of course, to get at the root of Boko Haram, since it is suspected that it is an Al-Qaeda related group. What, from what you know, from what we've been discussing, what do you think are the options now in Nigeria? What would you advise if you were to, I mean, just conjecturing here, from what your own observations and your own instincts tell you about what we have learned about what's going on in Nigeria, what would you say is the best course of action right now? 888-874-4888. Let's discuss that. You have to, I mean, what do you do? You have a president who clearly is as a mild-mannered man to begin with. He is said to be a born-again Christian. There's nothing wrong with that. But that, too, may be something that is influencing his approach. Does he have the stomach for war? Does he have the stomach for this kind of thing that you, some people will have to deal with as a matter of leadership in their country when their countries come under attack internally, where there's this kind of crazy stuff happening, this kind of chaos in your country, and you're not quite sure where it's coming from? Who's involved? What are the objectives? And you have internally all these other factors that are creating and contributing to the chaos. You have a military that is in disarray. The soldiers are angry at their superior officers, and there's widespread corruption and all kinds of charges that the soldiers are not being paid, or they don't have the right equipment, and they don't have the weapons that they need. You have the ethnic tensions that are occurring. You have religious tensions that are contributing to this. You have all kinds of things that are going on. You have ridiculous wealth in the north of the country and intolerable poverty on the other side of the country. A country that is now the number one economy, where more than 60% of Nigerians are living at or below poverty levels. These are the contradictions. So there's no easy answer here. But from your understanding of what is going on, from the discussions we've had, what would you suggest is the next, is the best course of action next? What are your ideas? What is happening, you think, in Nigeria? We're going to be discussing this, but I'm interested in what you're thinking. What do you think is going on in Nigeria? What is the best route to take? What ought to happen now before it gets even worse? And it will get worse, because if after the bombings in Jos, we had these two other bombings that claimed another 26 lives in two different villages near where these girls were kidnapped from, it is a signal to say, we have you. We are in charge. We could do anything we want, anytime we want, and we can cause immense crisis in this country. We have that kind of power. Is the president responding appropriately? Would this sink Nigeria into deeper crisis? Because now the question would be, do we tolerate this president much longer, or do we get rid of him? Would the military step in and say, look, we cannot operate under a president who doesn't seem to know what to tell us to do, and we will have to take charge now? I mean, all these things are now opened up, and it is a catastrophe on many levels, because this is how many nations actually are lost. In the middle of all of these things, these fights that are created sometimes as smokescreens to let other things happen, other agendas come forward, and they're carried out, and people are confused as to where to put or where to invest their attention and their energy and the resources. But one thing we do know is that Nigeria is very rich in resources for a country with such a dichotomy between rich and poor. It is oil rich, and the richest man in Africa is from Nigeria. So let's suggest that you are an advisor. You're an advisor to this government. What would you say the next move should be? I know people would be very uncomfortable about this, because obviously you don't want to say things that would make you look like that you're a hawk. But this is a tough call. What is your tough call? What is your response to this tough call? Should there be martial law? Should there be a military operation? Should the president be just sidelined? Should new elections be held right away, or some other mechanism of appointing a new leader, or a coalition of leaders? What would the formula be in approaching the next step for Nigeria, as you see it? 888-874-4888. While I wait for your calls, I want to remind you, of course, that Friday is Free Your Mind Friday. And I'm wondering, we hear the same voices a lot. How come we're not hearing from those folks I get all these emails from? I guess one of the issues is, of course, that they're working while they're listening to the show, so they can't actually make phone calls. So I understand that. But let's hear the voices, too. Let's hear those voices that are longing to be heard. 888-874-4888. I'm asking you, if you were in a position to advise on what ought to be done, what is the next logical step that Nigeria should take? What would your advice be? What do you think is happening in Nigeria from your particular perspective, based on what we know? And of course, we are limited in what we know. We don't know everything. But from what we know, from our guest, Dr. Chika Onyane, who has been guiding us through this particular story, he has told us certain things that make sense and that should give us an idea of what's going on. And, of course, I'm sure you've been keeping up with the story. But what is the next best step? Do we have a caller? You're getting shy all of a sudden? Well, this is where most developing nations are. They may not be in the kind of crisis, they may not be at that level of crisis as Nigeria is, but they're dealing with very serious contradictions internally, and this requires a certain kind of leadership that is meant to respond to things like this. Hello, Allie from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Idris.
Hello.
How are you doing? Idris, I just have to say that I don't know if I will be able to advise him the right way, because, first of all, how am I guarantee that the people that are holding those girls, they don't work in with the United States of America, France, England? and all those other European countries that they would like to acquire the richness that is in that land right now, that is on that land right now. So I, and another thing is about Michelle Obama. Michelle Obama is the same woman who asked for money for the Red Cross to go into Haiti. And can Michelle Obama tell me where the money went? So how can I believe that woman who said, bring back those girls? Bring back those girls? How can I even trust her? So the first thing that I would say is, how can I trust that that group that is holding those girls? It's not another group like Al-Qaeda, who the United States provided arms and negotiate with them back when these supposed terrorists, they were in Afghanistan fighting the Russians, and the U.S. were helping. And so did also the Sandinista in Nicaragua.
All right. Thank you, Ali, for your call today.
Thank you.
From New Jersey, Michael, what is your take on it, and what would your advice be?
Hi, Utrecht. So it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Same here.
I have a little experience with Nigeria because I know somebody who worked for a Nigerian company, and they have such dire poverty and such extreme wealth as a, you know, a dichotomy that that country is so unstable. It's going to be tremendously unstable. The thing about these kind of situations was in the past, if you had a Cuba or something like that, you could actually have some kind of a revolution. But now with these countries with mass military power, there's total suppression of these pressures that build within a society. And as far as Nigeria, there's tremendous pressures, and the only way that, you know, the people can't rebel. I would advise Jonathan Goodluck. First of all, I would say good luck.
But well, that's his first name. Good luck, Jonathan.
Yeah. But the thing is, he's got to institute immediate social reform on a great scale because the pressures in that country build so much. I know, the person I know who worked for a Nigerian company got off the plane there, was ushered in a limousine with Uzis and, you know, people carrying guns to the hotel. They couldn't leave the hotel. They went from the hotel to the company, back to the hotel. You couldn't show your face outside. It's unsafe. And even in this great hotel there in Nigeria, there's rolling blackouts, you know, in a country that has lots of oil. They don't seem to be able to generate enough electricity or heat the water. You can't take a warm shower there. And this is in a luxury hotel. So what you're talking about is you have the Chinese in there competing for oil. They're trying to develop the oil there. They've got a foothold, and they're competing with, multinational companies. And so they've got all the power, and the government is a tool for these multinationals that are, you know, gobbling up the resources in the country. And there's this extreme poverty, and the people who are not poor there are rich. There's nothing in the middle whatsoever. The people who are rich live in compounds, and they don't even brush their teeth by themselves. They have complete... From the moment they rise, it's like the Gilded Age. You know, from the moment they rise, they have servants that get paid nothing, and they don't even have to dress themselves, and they're driven to work, and they're driven back, and they live in compounds with barbed wire around it.
So what would you expect should happen next?
There has to be a massive. There has to be a massive reform, social reform. The government's got to be, you know, top to bottom, political reform, social reform, you know, educational reform, everything. And they've got to do something because I guess right now the people can't do anything because, you know, what you have there is terrorism now, which is going to be the upshot of all this. And I don't know what's going to happen. I think you're going to have countries like the United States and China and the people who have the vested interest there in terms of the multinationals and the money, but they're going to have their own military power, suppress, you know, lay down suppression, mm-hmm. and try to, you know, I guess they'll try to institute some kind of social reform to get something going for the people of the country, because it's ripe for terrorism. I'm not surprised with any of these things. In fact, I don't think that the people there are surprised about these kidnappings, because they happen all the time.
Well, they've been going on for quite some time now, and the violence is getting worse. Thanks a lot, Michael, for your contribution today. From Brooklyn, Veronica, you're on the air.
Yes, good day. Hi.
Hello. Hello, Veronica. How are you?
Okay. I was calling because I thought, just from observing, I thought that if the CIA sponsored this or any of the groups, it seems to me England is playing, oh, I'm on this side, I'm on one side versus America on the other side. So they would kind of make it like a North and South Korea, you know. From the time that the New York Times said that the Nigerians were the happiest people in the world, I said, oh, that's the next place they plan to infiltrate. I also said that it is amazing that they have been doing this for years, but all of a sudden this group made the news. And it would benefit whom? If all the U.S. and all these countries decided to put their army in there, who would end up being the poorest nation in Africa when they're done? They would do it more or less. It would end up as what they did with Iraq. It would happen as even right now, Verizon is sponsored by Israel. And if you're at war, why are these companies? It's if you are a nation that is black or African leadership and so forth, you are going to be infiltrated and destroyed. That's the bottom line. So asking, good luck asking for help from the countries that are destroying other countries, it is no benefit to Africa. That's how I see it.
But the saying goes, if your house is on fire, do you care who is bringing the water to put it out?
No, you do not. You do not care who's bringing the water, and that's exactly what. If we make it a North Nigeria versus South Nigeria, the bottom line is the U.S. can come in, England can come in, and the oil companies will be owned by whom? Yes, as you said, if they put the water out, you have to be careful of it. So you have to focus. Focus. Be very careful who you, where the water is coming from, and make sure they have, they sign contracts that you write that they will provide, cleaning up everything that they do when it's over.
But what is the it?
What is the hit?
What is the it? When you say when it's over, what is the it that you're referring to?
When they come in, as you say, if your house is on fire, you don't care who the water comes from. But make sure that they don't leave with the resources when it's over.
Okay.
If anything that they use, that they also provide equal. Don't come there and blow the whole country up and have it look like Iraq when you're done. Or Gaza.
So you do expect that there will be a response, a military response within Nigeria to this group called Boko Haram. You do expect or anticipate that there will be a military response.
I expect the fact that you ask Israel for help. What help have they given to the Gaza Strip? If you ask for your, I would say, if you ask for your master on the plantation to help you get to freedom, it is also a problem. That's That's the way I see it. That's the bottom line.
All right. Well, thank you for your thoughts today. Thanks so much for calling in. Well, as you can see, this is not an easy issue, because now you're dealing with some historical issues about the experience of colonialism, not only in Nigeria, but on the continent as a whole. Just about every nation, every African nation, has been at one point or the other a colony of some other nation. We have the fear of the recolonization of Nigeria. But in the meantime, we have a problem. There is this problem, and it is not going away. It is getting more and more vicious, and somehow it has to be responded to. What is the appropriate response? And this is the dilemma. If Nigeria were to get enough of a military response, then it would have crossed a line definitively. It would have crossed a line as a government having to wage war within its own borders, and it's going to involve its own citizens. If you take foreign help, as Veronica said, you're going to be taking help from people who, they're bringing the water to help you put out the fire, but that's not their only aim. You know, they have vested interests there too. You have the reality of dealing with the rise of Al-Qaeda and its sympathetic cells all over the world, and especially in Africa, where they are seeking a foothold, and they have been at this for some time. You have this religious issue. Do you, as a born-again Christian, do you bear the burden of declaring war, which will involve killing and bombing and all the acts of war that are antithetical to that belief? All these things. So we will be monitoring this story as it continues, and we will be asking for your opinions. Thanks so much for today. I hope that the subjects caused a little bit of inquiry on your own, and that you will be following up the stories with us as we proceed. Thanks so much for joining me. Today, you want to stay tuned, because Alternative Visions is next with Dr. Jack Rasmus. And we will be seeing each other again tomorrow. Write me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Thanks so much. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company.